From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we look at comparisons between the Act 10 protests in Madison and the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Then we talk about the power rhetoric has when it comes from elected officials.
And so I think it's really going to be incumbent upon politicians that they use their words carefully, even if they aren't in danger of being criminally prosecuted for their words.
Plus, we meet the first Asian American person elected to the state legislature and hear her plans to push for more equitable laws.
It's so important to build opportunities for all of our communities right now, and the fact that I have one and have been so supported in this opportunity is beyond humbling.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we hear from the first Asian American and the first Muslim to be elected to the state legislature. We examine the First Amendment and where the line is drawn between protected speech and inciting violence. Plus, we feature some of the latest Listen MKE, where local leaders talk about their experience with COVID-19. But first, we look at comparisons between the Act 10 protests in Madison and the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. After Trump extremists stormed the Capitol, some of Wisconsin's conservative commentators were quick to compare it to the 2011 protests in Madison, which occupied the state capitol for 4 months. And while the images of thousands of people inside a historic government building may seem comparable, the similarities may end there. Journalist Mary Spacuzza covered the Act 10 protests, and although she says there were tense moments, nothing compared to the brutality witnessed in D.C. Spacuzza joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about these comparisons.
When the insurrection happened at the U.S. Capitol, there were some conservative personalities here in Wisconsin who almost immediately started pushing this comparison between Act 10 protests in Madison and what many are calling a failed coup. We'll get into the details in just a moment, but where do these comparisons begin and end?
You know, I first started hearing about them from colleagues who mentioned that conservative talk show hosts had drawn those comparisons, as well as current lawmakers like Jim Steinke, former lawmakers like Michelle Lichens, and our former governor, Scott Walker, who joined in later in the week to make that comparison. I was a bit surprised, honestly, when I first heard that people were comparing the two, just because they really were so different. And I think it's fair to say that both involved large crowds of people and both were loud and occurred in and around historic buildings. But really, the similarities quickly ended after just those basics. They were just extremely different things. And what happened in D.C. with the violence, the deaths, the police officer who was killed, the weapons, we just never saw that during Act 10.
You mentioned what I think is maybe the biggest difference, the violence. How does that compare to what we saw happen in Madison?
From what we're hearing in D.C., it sounds like that police officer was struck in the head with a fire extinguisher is, I believe, what happened. You know, there were some tense points during Act 10, and I think there were some times where some of us in the press corps who were watching things unfold were nervous that things would get violent. But really, these were overwhelmingly peaceful protests, which is pretty remarkable considering how long they lasted. You know, these stretched from mid-February of 2011 for days, weeks, and it involved an occupation of the Capitol where people were sleeping in the rotunda and the halls. They stretched on, they grew very, very quickly by tens of thousands of people. And to have that many people in a building and around a building with really no deaths, no violence, no weapons charges, it was pretty remarkable and obviously very different from what we saw in D.C. last week.
It was very different, of course, at the U.S. Capitol. The violence beyond the people who were killed was pretty remarkable. There was a lot of violence against police officers. There are videos, of course, that you can see that are really disturbing. One of the other things that came out of this is many of the extremists were armed, of course, during the insurrection. Some appeared to also have supplies to take hostages. And there was a gallows constructed outside of the Capitol. When we compare that to Madison, what do we find?
I did see a photo of that noose that was fashioned outside the Capitol. I never saw anything like that during Act 10. The zip ties that people reportedly had inside the Capitol, where they were like the plastic zip ties that could be used for restraining people. We never saw anything like that during Act 10. People were far more likely to have, you know, bongo drums, vuvuzelas, red heart balloons, but not assault weapons and things to restrain or kidnap people.
We're now seeing a lot of arrests that happened after, of course, the insurrection itself. There were some arrests at the time, but a lot more since then. And people are facing some serious charges. What were arrests like at the Madison protests? And what kind of charges, if any, did these people face?
There were very few arrests during that period of, I would say, mid-February to mid-March. And some of them, there were about 16 people arrested, and about 9 of them were people who really wanted to kind of go down, you know, for the record books of having been arrested. So some of them, it was almost like, hey, I'll leave the Capitol, but I want to be charged. So it wasn't like the violent arrests or anything where people were being arrested with explosive devices or the Molotov cocktails or the weapons that people are facing charges with in D.C. I think former State Senator Grothman, now U.S. Representative, characterized it pretty accurately in an interview with him where he's just said that things just never reached that pitch in Madison. There was never a violent pitch. There was some tension. Grothman himself was actually locked out of the building once and surrounded by protesters during Act 10, and people were chanting shame at him, and Brett Halsey stepped in. And that was a tense moment, but again, you didn't see the violence, you didn't see people with any weapons or trying to physically attack him.
It didn't escalate the way the insurrection did.
Exactly. I mean, I will say it was loud. There was a lot of drumming, but again, loud noises is nothing compared to what we saw last week.
Well, and when we compare loud noises to the physical damage that was done to the U.S. Capitol, it seems like they don't seem to compare. Did we see that same kind of property damage during the Act 10 protests?
There was some very minor property damage. You know, our Capitol in Madison is beautiful, and it's a landmark, and I don't think anybody wants to see any damage to it at all. That said, the damage that we've been hearing about out of D.C. was the ransacking of offices, the destruction of furniture, artwork, defacing of sculptures, things being stolen or smashed, feces being spread. We didn't see anything like that during Act 10. There was some damage to the marble and stone in the Capitol. Some of that was like tape residue from protest signs being hung up, but they did actually have conversations beforehand with experts and apparently tried to use blue painter's tape because that's supposed to be gentler on marble. Initially, at one point, the Department of Administration estimated damages to be like $7.5 million. But they later acknowledged that that was kind of a rough guesstimate based on what was written on like a single line sheet of paper. And they later said it was, I think, $350,000. And then, if my memory serves correctly, about $270,000. But some of that, again, was, you know, tape residue. The grass outside the Capitol was ripped up just because there were so many people marching around it that there was some damage to, you know, the lawn. And there were a lot of overtime costs because with people occupying the building, they did bring in a lot of extra law enforcement. So I think the biggest costs in Madison during Act 10 were more those kind of overtime and what the DOA secretary called, like, he said it wasn't malicious damage. So I think that's probably a key difference from what we saw in D.C. with the vandalism.
It doesn't necessarily seem like purposeful damage either, which Obviously, the insurrectionists at the U.S. Capitol purposefully destroyed a lot of the furniture, destroyed some paintings, smashed windows. That also seems to get to really what's at the heart of these comparisons in general, which is motivation. And when we talk about Act 10 and the motivation behind the protests that existed inside of the Madison Capitol, how does that compare to the motivation for this insurrection?
You know, I think Act 10, then Governor Walker unveiled his plan to, you know, really all but strip collective bargaining from most of the state's public employees, aside from most police officers, you know, some others, but by far the vast majority of public workers were affected by Act 10. It really undid a lot of Wisconsin's, you know, labor policies and Wisconsin's traditions with labor. It was obviously extremely controversial, faced a lot of criticism, especially from, you know, unions, teachers, nurses. A lot of people came to the Capitol. But again, our Capitol is open for the most part. So they were not barging, busting doors and windows to get into restricted areas of the Capitol, which is obviously very different from what we saw when this was fundamentally about trying to stop Joe Biden's win from being formalized by Congress and by federal lawmakers. It's different than trying to convince lawmakers not to try to pass a bill. This was almost trying to just completely shut down government in an effort to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power from President Trump to President-elect Joe Biden. That's not to say that some windows weren't damaged in Madison, because, you know, most people just entered the building. There were some people who climbed through windows, especially the night of a conference committee in March when the bill was passed by Republican senators. So there were people climbing through a few windows, and there were some windows that were damaged. But again, very different than the images coming out of D.C. We didn't see people forcefully storming a building. You know, no officers were crushed in doors, like some of the disturbing footage that we saw in D.C. Doors weren't being smashed down and windows shattered through, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and ultimately no one was murdered.
Right. That's a big difference. And there were, you know, obviously some of the deaths were medical emergencies in D.C., but yes, no officers were injured or murdered during Act 10. There was a there was an officer who was hurt trying to help someone having a mental health emergency that took place during Act 10. This was a person who had just been at Mendota and was not even affiliated with the protests. And that officer, you know, unfortunately, I believe hurt their like neck and back trying to help someone down from a high point that they were concerned they would jump from, but really nothing like what we saw in D.C.
So you mentioned, of course, some of the politicians and personalities who have been pushing this comparison. Have they faced any backlash?
Yes, they have. And I think it's very interesting, because I think that there are people who want to say this was exactly the same. And this has been mainly conservatives and Republicans, not all of them, though, but some. But I think the pushback has been, you know, this is kind of a false equivalency to compare a overwhelmingly peaceful protest that may have been loud and may have been a lot of people, and they didn't leave initially when they were first asked to leave. But that's very different than a violent insurrection coup attempt and the activities we saw in D.C.
Yeah. Well, Mary, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and for sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who reported on the Act 10 protests in 2011. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. One of the central tenets of democracy is the freedom of speech and expression. There's been a lot of debate on free speech and what it means to incite violence following the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Senator Ron Johnson originally planned to object to the state's Electoral College votes. Following the insurrection, Johnson changed his mind, but continued to object to another state's results. Paul Nolet is a professor of political science at Marquette University. He said moving forward, he's hopeful elected officials will recognize the power behind their rhetoric. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about defining when free speech is protected and what role social media plays.
How do you draw the line between free speech and inciting violence?
Yeah, it's a difficult question and one that really the courts and society both have wrestled with for many, many decades now. Under the current law and the interpretation of the First Amendment by the Supreme Court, there's really not a whole lot that fits into that category of incitement. It's really difficult for actions, words, to be able to be prosecuted criminally. There was a important case called Brandenburg versus Ohio from 1969, in which the test there is that the speech has to result in inciting imminent lawless action. So, and it's a very difficult test to try to meet that.
And we've seen the phrase and heard the phrase fake news tossed around a lot during this administration, which has had some of the attitude of that the media is the enemy of the people. We've also seen new news organizations pop up that have, I guess, their own versions of the truth, or there are some instances where there are falsehoods reported from some of these new, you know, far right organizations. How does that fall in line with free speech, with slander, with libel? How does that get by that kind of thing?
Yeah, and this is another area where the law and courts have been very protective of media organizations when it comes to stories that they run and so forth. And there's a standard in the law that requires proof of actual malice if the government is to prosecute a media organization or others in the media for something that they published. And, you know, this goes back to the days of the civil rights protests of the 1960s and a number of Southern politicians that thought that they were being libeled by the New York Times and other prominent media organizations and brought lawsuits saying that they were getting slandered and libeled. And the Supreme Court and other federal courts were very skeptical of these claims, looking at them saying, really what they're trying to do is quash protest and even just reporting on protest like the New York Times had been doing. The courts have been really skeptical of trying to police that boundary between, you know, true news and fake news and made it really difficult for prosecutions or lawsuits targeting those media organizations to happen. So, you know, unless anything changes dramatically in that area, it's really going to be difficult to, you know, bring any sort of legal claims against media organizations for allegedly libeling, slandering, or otherwise engaging in fake news.
Some Republican senators said that they were going to object to the Electoral College votes in certain states, and Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson was among those. How well do you think Wisconsin politicians grasp the power of their own rhetoric, especially in this divisive environment?
Yeah, and this is something where I think that there will have to be some reckoning among politicians who, you know, may not have been inciting violence directly themselves, but their actions and their words have foreseeable consequences that led to something like the breach of the Capitol and the deaths of, you know, I think now five people directly coming out of that event last week. And so I think it's really going to be incumbent upon politicians that they use their words carefully, even if they aren't in danger of being criminally prosecuted for their words and it, you know, reaching that Brandenburg test of imminent lawless violence that their words are causing. I think it's important that they think about the consequences of their words. And if it's foreseeable that it's going to rile people up in a way that's going to really be damaging for American democracy, I think they have a responsibility to really monitor their words and think seriously about, you know, how they're using their platform and their rhetoric.
I want to talk about the role of private businesses in this discussion on free speech and inciting violence and what is and isn't okay. So what do you think about Twitter and Facebook banning President Trump and Apple, Google, and Amazon taking the app Parlay off their hosting services? Is this policing speech by a private company, or how would you explain this?
I think from the outset, it is important to say that, you know, Twitter and Facebook and these other companies, Google, are within their legal rights to do this. They are not limited by the First Amendment, which only applies to state actors, so essentially government actors. That being said, there are some concerns, I think, that have been raised across the political aisle even before the events of the last week about the power of social media companies and big tech and whether they have too much of an influence over the public sphere and public square these days. Millions of Americans, and outside of the United States too, of course, communicate via Twitter and Facebook and other prominent social media companies. And, you know, if they make decisions to ban people from the platform, that is a great deal of power. Now, it may be entirely appropriate for that to happen to ensure that violence doesn't occur, but it does raise some important questions, I think, about their overall power in society.
And some of these social media companies have even been asking for more government oversight. And what is your take on the argument that labeling posts with warnings or removing them altogether is a violation of someone's right to freely express themselves?
Technically, it's not a restriction of the right, given that no one has a right to, say, tweet, because Twitter is a private company. That being said, it raises, I think, some of the same issues as permanently banning someone from a platform to say, well, now you're going to have a big tech company essentially editorializing about things that are posted on their platform. And I'm sure that many critics of President Trump have supported that and do support these warnings. And I think many of them very well might be appropriate, particularly with many of the falsehoods that he was circulating about the election and how it was stolen, which were all false completely. That being said, I mean, do you really want a big company with no real accountability saying things about, you know, what people are posting on their platform? I could see that going Breaking Bad in a number of ways. And so I think there really needs to be a conversation about whether they should have that power.
Paul Nolet is a professor of political science at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Fex Becca Schimmel about defining the line between free speech and inciting violence. Coming up, local leaders talk about their experience being diagnosed with COVID-19, how it affected them, and how they're recovering. That's in about 20 minutes. But first, Wisconsin voters made history in November, electing the first Muslim and the first Asian American to the state legislature.
Apart from being a Muslim, an immigrant, coming from the smallest country in Africa, mainland Africa, to the United States, and be able to serve at this level, I think is really, really remarkable.
We'll hear from both of the new representatives next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin voters made history in November by electing the first Asian American to the state legislature. Francesca Hong is a chef and restaurant owner. She was elected to represent the state's 76th Assembly District, which covers a portion of Madison. She spoke to WUWM's Latoya Dennis about the work that lies ahead. She begins by explaining her feelings about being elected.
I am both incredibly motivated, grateful, and terrified at the same time.
What are you most grateful for?
The opportunity. I think
it's so important to build opportunities for all of our communities right now. And the fact that I have one and have been so supported in this opportunity is beyond humbling. And I think the fact that I've been able to meet so many people, you know, via Zoom, it makes meeting people actually incredibly efficient. and connect with them in a time where a connection is so needed and yet so lost. I am just grateful for that opportunity and to hear about, you know, what people in the community are doing to build resilience and to really navigate these times. I think it's so important for people in leadership, especially when it's elected officials, to be hearing directly from their community and implementing some of the strategies that you know, our community has created, you know, whether that be in the small business or in nonprofits or what neighborhoods are doing. It's our job as elected officials to try to implement that in government to make it more functioning and serve people better. So I am grateful for that opportunity and for all of these opportunities of connection.
So what have you heard from talking to people thus far that you'd like to put into practice at the state level?
I want people to be able to feel like they can hold their elected officials accountable to create more equitable opportunities for all communities, because right now so many of our communities aren't able to participate in the ways that they would like to. For example, I know that in the small business community, like so many other communities right now, you know, equity is an issue. In restaurants in particular, haven't really ever talked about anti-Blackness or the fact that we as businesses with opportunities to feed people can't really just look at ourselves as a business anymore, that I think we have a responsibility to do more and to look at our hiring practices and look at who has opportunities to open restaurants and thrive in them. And so I think, you know, communities are asking elected officials to look at the conditions that are driving inequality and how between, you know, small business development and in nonprofit sectors or even in government sectors, we need to be thinking critically about changing these conditions. And that's going to come with a lot of uncomfortable conversations about who's getting money and funding. And so, you know, communities, I think, are really demanding that elected officials advocate and amplify that message and that they are seen and then they are heard. And it's my job not only to amplify those messages, but to make sure that leaders in the communities have an active role in the conversation when it comes to decision making, and that, you know, they are feeling like, because I know a lot of especially leaders in communities of color are being brought into a lot of conversations, but I don't know how many of those conversations are leading to actionable next steps. And so the accountability factor here is to make sure that elected officials can ensure that there are next steps, that there are next actions, and that we are looking not only at changing the conditions to make our communities more equitable, but that our communities have a larger voice.
Now, it's interesting that you use the word equitable, because that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has access to the same things.
I use equitable and because I think there's a difference that we don't always talk about between equity and equality. And it's an opportunity and access problem. And we don't often see as the different conditions, you know, when people talk about systemic racism, I don't know if we go further into you know, the practices of that in our neighborhoods. And so whether that, and you have to look a lot at the history of how neighborhoods are zoned and created, to what's going on in terms of who's placed near harmful environmental conditions, you know, what's affordable and what's not in certain areas of the cities, who has access to be able to open their own business and where. You know, I'm talking to a lot of different business owners who what we have found is that, you know, especially in the restaurant industry, there are people who have different relationships with financial institutions and their landlords. And you're seeing a lot of Black, Brown, Indigenous, and Asian business leaders who are unable to create better relationships with their white landlords. And I think that's a conversation we have to have about, you know, how that
discourages opportunities for people to thrive economically and run the businesses that they want to in their way. So it's absolutely a conversation about access and opportunity. But I think beyond that, we have to make sure that we're talking about that access being a right and not just a condition that we're looking at.
When we began this conversation, you said you were grateful, terrified, and motivated. What's motivating you?
I'm motivated because, you know, a restaurant owner and a chef to win an assembly seat in and of itself was motivating to me to have more representation, to have actual voices of working class people. And I know that I am an employer, but because I own a small business doesn't mean that I am rolling in the dough. Restaurants are not that industry. And if you're in the restaurant industry for money, you're in the wrong industry. Because for me, it's always been about community, and my community was harmed. Our community was harmed. And so, you know, I felt motivated to increase participation and visibility and representation. And I had a community that backed me on all of that. And so now I'm accountable to make sure that everything that I talked about, you know, is I want people to hold their elected officials accountable. I want people to believe that power in this country can be held accountable.
Now, when you talk about your community, who exactly are you speaking of?
The restaurant community and the service industry workers who were pivotal in helping me stay motivated and you know, talking to so many different service industry workers who had lost their jobs, whether they be servers or bartenders, cooks or dishwashers, you know, issues that they were having with unemployment, issues that they have with rising rents in this city. You know, that service industry community is incredibly important to me and their families. I also have a growing relationship now with the Asian American community and the Asian community, and then reaching out to leaders who represent other communities, whether that be an activist community that's growing here in Madison, to, you know, grassroots organizations.
Now, you said a growing relationship with the Asian American community. One, you are the state's first Asian American elected to the legislature. What does that mean to you? And two, what do you mean when you say a growing relationship?
For me, growing up in Madison, I had very few Asian friends. I had very few Asian American friends. And to be honest, I don't think I really went out of my way to make Asian American friends. You know, there was a code switch episode the other day about, you know, Asian Americans being probably the largest demographic to have interracial friendships. And that's due to our proximity to whiteness and really feeling compelled to assimilate more so than others. And I think I had privileges to be able to do that. But what that actually did was put me in a perpetual state of wondering what my identity was. And becoming the first AAPI elected to the state assembly, I think, is really one of the first times that I am proud and stand with my Korean American identity. And I think that resonates with a lot of Asian Americans in the community. And so when I say I have a growing relationship, it's because I have a lot of work to do to build trust with Hmong leaders, with Asian students on campus, with and really seek out other leaders in the smaller Asian community, but that, you know, no understanding that we have a growing demographic. My racial identity serves me in a way that it is going to help me foster these relationships with leaders in Asian communities. And I hope that it also allows people to see that we do not have to be defined in one way, that, you know, our identity as Asian Americans is fluid, and we have, we can be agents of how we define that. And so for me, representation matters, but it comes with responsibility. And I think if anything, I'm more grateful because it's helped me clear up my own and think critically about my racial identity.
Representative Francesca Hong is the first Asian American elected to the Wisconsin legislature. She spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. We continue hearing from some Wisconsin lawmakers making history now. Samba Balde is the first Muslim elected to the Wisconsin legislature. Before becoming representative, Balde served on the Madison Common Council. He now represents Wisconsin's 48th Assembly District. He spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis about what he hopes to accomplish and why he ran for public office.
In 2014, you know, if you had paid attention to the socioeconomic situations in the country and also the political environment around that time, there was a lot of issues between law enforcement and people of color, just like what prevailed in the last year or so. Now, I've been an advocate for all my life generally, and still not seeing about the change that I've been advocating. In 2014, when you know things were just not good, the relationship between law enforcement and particularly Black people was not at its best, I decided that, you know what, I think the problem is not how much I advocate out there, it's what laws are in the books. And so to be at the table and be part of that process of legislation and things of that nature probably bring about the change. But also just being out there, you know, obviously being an advocate, I think it's always better to be at the table and advocate for things that you believe in than just advocating in the streets or to agencies or lawmakers and things like that.
So were there issues outside of the relationship between Black people and the police that spurred you to run for office?
I also saw a lot of disparities in the communities that I live, but also the places that I work. Discrimination now, everybody is saying is systemic. But, you know, being a Black person, I lived it. And so, and being that person who almost always, you know, asks himself, what are you doing about the situations that you are not happy about with? I always find a way to do something. And so that was another reason why I decided to run for office, to make sure that I am, you know, at the table where these decisions are made, but also probably give me a better platform to advocate for the communities where I am particularly coming from, but also our poor communities. You know, America has a lot of communities that are struggling, particularly recently in the wake of COVID and things like that. So this, among others, were the reason why I ran for, in the first place, for city council. And then eventually for state assembly is obviously to serve my people at the higher level. Serving in the city, what I realize is that many of our resources are controlled by the state. So we do not have access to doing many things that we would have been able to do if it was not the restraint at the state level. So being at the state level will give me that leverage really to find a way to support our lower municipalities or, you know, authorities. In other words, you know, advocate for things that the cities are not able to do right now. So, but also service a bigger constituents, the state district, much more bigger than the city district. So that gives me the opportunity to reach out to a different constituent, but also a bigger constituents. And hopefully with that large constituents and my access to resources, we can make not only the city better, but the state.
Now, are you coming in with ideas already that you'd like to put forth?
Yeah, so obviously, there are a good number of things that need to happen as we go into our first year. One of them is Medicaid. And the reason for this is mainly COVID. We realize that during this time, particularly communities of color or poor communities in general are struggling to have access to healthcare. So expanded Medicaid so people have insurance, I think is important. But also as a result of Medicaid, as a result of COVID, rebuilding our economy is also very important. I mean, many of our small businesses will never come back. And so how do we make sure that the ones that are still there trying to do something stay there? So corrections, you know, obviously our criminal justice system is broken. So I really want to work hard to make sure that revisitism is reduced. So that when people are out of jail, they are not going back there every other, you know, little mistake they make while they're on probation and things like that. But also, you know, just funding our criminal justice system, so people are not pleading guilty to sometimes things that they've not done. So these are some of the top agenda items. Obviously, housing, like I said, is very important. So WIDA has provided significant support to Madison and its core group of developers, but we still need a lot of work to be done. The home ownership for people of color, particularly Black people in the state, is basically unimaginable. It's last in the whole country generally.
Now, I'm wondering, because obviously you're going to be entering a state legislature that is Republican controlled, right? And it seems as though the two sides, Democrats and Republicans, haven't really been able to agree on much in recent years. How do you plan to work in that environment?
Being at the city council for the last 6 years, it's not partisan, but people have strong opinion. But being able to work with my colleagues there and make things happen, I think I'll continue using the same approach, that is to see the work as an assignment from the people who elected us, that this shouldn't be personal. You know, the water we drink does not know Republican, does not know Democrats. What it knows is that is people who is drinking it. And so the issue of employment doesn't know who is a Republican, who is Democrat. The issue of housing, the issue of, you know, being able to pay your rent, you know, good jobs, good paying jobs, so you can take care, one can take care of their families and things. So, but I am really very conscious of the fact that the Republicans are in charge. But I do believe that they also represent constituencies that share the same issues with the constituencies that I represent. So I will reach out to them and talk to them on issues that some of them care about. I have already started reading what many of them have been working on. So hopefully I can find some relationship through reading their history in terms of legislation and be able to bring some of them to the table and do the people's work.
Samba, I'm speaking to you because you're the first Muslim elected to the state legislature in Wisconsin. How does that feel for you?
So it feels pretty good. I mean, but generally, you know, just from where I came from, apart from being a Muslim, an immigrant, coming from the smallest country in Africa, mainland Africa, to the United States, and be able to serve at this level, I think is really, really remarkable. But, you know, that being said, I'm also very grateful to the communities that I serve, to the people who believe in me and keep voting for me since 2015. And that also make it even more challenging for me, that if people have all this trust in me, believing in my agenda and my advocacy and my work, then it is also a big weight on me to really make sure that I deliver. And so I am grateful to the people who elected me, but also the districts that I represent, the constituencies that I represent. So it feels very good, but at the same time, really is a lot of challenge. So it's gratifying, and really I am humbled by it.
Do you think that your religion plays a part in the issues that are important to you or that you've advocated for over the years?
To some extent, yes. I do not govern based off of any religion, but I do think, for example, I was brought up to support others, people who are doing much less than I am doing well. So I'm also brought up in a culture where giving back is the norm. I mean, it may be surprising to some other people that coming from a developing country or what some other people call poor countries, these kind of norms do not exist. But every religion teaches you to be, treat your, you know, neighbor or treat the other person the way you would like to be treated. So these are some of the belief system that really get me into this space. It's more about not how I connect with my God, but what my God has advised me to work with my community. And so those are the things that I use to make sure that I am able to be a good neighbor, a good human being. The way I govern is totally completely different from the way I connect with my God per se. But I do take what the religion that I believe advises me as to how I should deal with people. And I think that is what is helpful, that we are all called to help those who are struggling. You know, do what you would do to yourself, do it to others, as opposed to just sitting there and not being a part of the community. And so that way it does play a role.
Representative Samba Balde is the first Muslim elected to serve in the state's legislature. He spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. In the latest Listen MKE, we heard from local leaders about their experience with COVID-19. We'll listen back to some of that event next on Lake Effect, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. WUWM has been partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and the Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE. The latest event focused on local leaders' experience with COVID-19. The virus disproportionately affected Milwaukee's Black community, and many of the survivors continue to face unique physical and mental health challenges. The latest conversation focused on those experiences and challenges. It took place on Monday on Facebook Live. Among the guests was Reverend Greg Lewis. Here's a portion of what he shared during the event.
I got my results and I was devastated because I knew it might mean that, you know, death for me. You know, I'm diabetic and I'm 62 years old, and I was devastated when they told me that. You know, I almost. But they told me to just lay around and rest and take plenty of Tylenol, drink plenty of liquids. And I was laying there and I was dying. I told my wife, I said, baby, I'm dying, you know. And so we got a invitation to go to the hospital, and I took it. And when I got there, the doctors, you know, they asked me three questions. They said, are you do you have all your business in order? I was like, wow. I said, yeah, who's going to take care of it? I said, my wife. Then they asked me, if you stop breathing, do you want us to resuscitate you? And I was like, huh? You know, and then, you know, the doctor said, you know, that's okay, because if you become unconscious, we won't be able to resuscitate you. And, you know, they expected me to die. But what I didn't know is that not only did I have bronchitis, you know, I had pneumonia and I had a lung infection, and I'm diabetic. So they were, you know, they expected me to die, but, you know, I didn't, you know, because they filled me up with antibiotics, but I fought off the COVID-19 with my own body. So, you know, that was important, you know. And then the third thing the doctor told me was that if you don't do exactly what we say, you're going to die. And, you know, I said, wow, you know, they had counted me out. You know, I thought I was going to die. And I probably would have. If I not got to the hospital on March 27th, I would have died. When I was in ICU, I had about six friends die while I was laying there in ICU, because I kept my phone and they were texting me, letting me know what was going on the outside. But my faith kind of kept me stabilized. I was afraid after I couldn't walk, I couldn't taste anything, I couldn't eat. I didn't eat for 3 weeks. If I picked up a bottle of water, it felt like a 20-pound weight. You know, all I could do was lay there, or else I would be sore from just moving because I was so fatigued and I was totally debilitated. And I didn't know how sick I was, but my faith kind of kept me, you know, going. And, you know, I had a call from the hospital the other day, and she was talking about how people have these things going on after all this COVID, and how, you know, she was expecting me to be going through some of the post traumatic syndromes of COVID. And I told her that, you know, my trust in God was so strong that I just didn't feel like, you know, that, you know, it was anything that I couldn't overcome. And so my mental state was good, but physically, I know I'm not fully healed. You know, from March till now, my respiratory system is not really as strong as it used to be. You know, even when you holler, you know, as a preacher, you know, sometimes you want to holler and you just can't holler. You know, you start to cough and I said, wow, I might never be the same. So in saying that, I'm going to say this. When I was dying, I was not afraid. But when I found out I was going to live, I was scared to death because I said, I'm never going to be the same. I was totally frightened when they said, you're going to be okay. I said, wow, am I going to be like this? Because I couldn't walk and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even go to the bathroom. I couldn't do anything. I thought I was going to be like that the rest of my life, but I recovered to the point I am now. Otherwise, man, I was afraid to death to live.
That was Milwaukee Reverend Greg Lewis, Executive Director of Souls to the Poles, talking about his experience with COVID-19. That was part of the latest Listen MKE event that took place on Facebook Live on Monday. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. You can find the full conversation at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Becca Schimmel and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Angelina Mosher Salazar from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.